Think you know fear? Think you've experienced the edge of madness? Think again. Enter the world of Session 9, Brad Anderson's cult classic that has haunted horror fans for over two decades. Now the nightmare returns, not on your screen, but on the page. Written by Christian Francis, the author behind the official novelizations of Wishmaster, Vamp, and Creature, this new take on Session 9 delves deeper into the psychological nightmare of the Danvers State Hospital. This is not just a retelling. Francis unearths backstories, revives lost scenes, and brings the most chilling moments of the original script to life in haunting detail. Available now in ebook, paperback, hardcover, and an audiobook towards the end of the year. Visit session9book.com to find out where you can get your hands on this must-read for any horror lover. Do it for Pop-Pop. And that leaves our corporate overlords. Yes, Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including, from time to time, little old me, your intrepid KingCast host. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you'll need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you gotta do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save a whopping, astronomical, massive, gargantuan 25% off of your subscription. That's code KingCast at Fangoria.com. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Red Rum!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes dead is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm your host, Eric Vespi, and today we are turning our attention to The Mist, specifically Frank Darabont's 2007 adaptation starring Thomas Jane, Laurie Holden, Marcia Gay Harden, and the late, great Andre Brouwer. Joining me is a video game artist and developer who's worked on all the best games Bethesda ever put out, including Skyrim, Fallout, Starfield, all that stuff, before forming his own company, Just Perky Games, which has a new game out this month called The Axis Unseen, which is described as a heavy metal horror game. The demo is out now. The full game releases October 22nd. We'll talk about that and then dive into the horrors of The Mist. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the man who built Fallout 4's, Diamond City, Skyrim's, Blackreach. Please welcome Nate Perkypile to the KingCast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So a friend of mine, Alex, is the one who reached out and hooked us up. I guess he's working with you to help get some word out on the game. He knew I play Friday the 13th with this guy still to this day. Until they take the fucking servers offline, we will gather on Fridays every once in a while, maybe once a month, and play that janky ass game for a few hours and laugh our asses off. But he knew that I was a big Bethesda nerd and also a big Stephen King nerd. And he's like, hey, I think that this might be a good connection here. So when he reached out, the initial title that he was floating was Misery, and he said that you have an association with Misery on something, and we had just covered the title, so I was like, oh, it has to probably be something else, but I want to get into that. Like, why do you what is the Misery association that you have?
So I was like the lead artist on Fallout 76, and you know, we shipped that thing and basically the internet completely lost their minds and thought we were horrible people and, you know, death threats, the works. Mm-hmm. So watching, I haven't actually read the book, unfortunately, but watching that movie not too long ago, I was like, it resonated so much with toxic fandom and like, no, it needs to be the way we want it to be. And it's not to say that like people didn't have, you know, things that they were wrong about and like the game got better and all that, but like that level of toxicity and like, yeah, you know, I feel you.
I couldn't understand it as so I was in an odd spot. I'm sure that if I was any like more established in the gaming world that I probably would have had like a little mini like we got to investigate this guy for liking this game thing happen. But I had left Ain't It Cool News before 76 came out, and I was working at Rooster Teeth when 76 came out, and they knew I was the big Fallout nerd. So when the offer came in to do the junket for 76 and get some hands-on game play, they're like, oh, we'll send Eric because he loves Fallout. And so, you know, I did the whole thing. We went to was it the Greenbrier?
Oh yeah. That, we may have actually met before then, because I was actually at that.
It's very positive. So yeah, I went there and, you know, got my, I think they gave us what, 2 hours or 3 hours of gameplay time, and recorded it all. And I'm sitting there going, man, this is Fallout. This is great. You know, and keeping in mind, we hadn't gotten to scratch that itch for a while. And so I was like, this is excellent. I just feel like I'm walking around and like, I loved the kind of deserted nature. I love the story aspect of it being, this is the first vault open, and thus the wasteland just, you know, is going to be that. It's going to be a wasteland. And so like everything that I liked about it, it turns out like that's where everybody and their mother decided like, oh, we hate this and this isn't working. And I came back going, guys, this feels like walking around in Fallout, and you're doing this stuff and you get to build this, and this is really cool. And it's taking all these things from 4 and building on it. And I came back excited about it, and like had edited up the gameplay and was like, did my reporting, and just like, this is a really fun game. I recommend it. And then like everybody else in the world just, I decided, and I've noticed that happen. I'm a movie guy, so I've noticed that happens a lot. There's a lot of dogpiling that goes on within film critics as well, circles. And I don't know what the phenomenon is, but it was especially bad around the time that 76 came out. That's when you had like the worst of The Last Jedi stuff, the Zack Snyder stuff was flaring up like the worst that it's ever been. There was just something in the water with fandom at that particular moment. And, you know, to your point, they, you know, they're not always wrong, but they're always assholes about it. You know what I mean? You know, it's right. A little bit of that Big Lebowski, Walter Sobchak thing. You're not wrong, you're just an asshole.
I didn't
get. So I still play 76, and I'm a first member, and I still play the game today. So I don't know.
I'm glad you still play it, and I agree that it's just like taking it too far. And yeah, I feel bad when it happens to other devs, because you can see the same cycle happen over and over, where it's like, oh, everybody loves The Witcher 3, and it's great, and they were like this underdog, but then they were successful, and then Cyberpunk, even if it had problems, like, it, again, wasn't that bad, but reached that same peak.
Well, it seems like the goalpost got moved. That was the thing that kind of perturbed me, where it's just like this, why wasn't this like Fallout New Vegas is, you know, that was the perfect thing. And I'm like, Fallout New Vegas is the only game that I ever ran into a fucking campaign killing bug. You know, it's like that was the only game where I got stuck in a like I entered a building too early or something. And then like I was stuck forever entering and exiting that building or something. You know, it's like people, the bugs in those giant open world things, those are kind of the, they're part of the package. You know that, you know, you're trading a little bit of jankiness for this crazy immersive experience. And I don't know. I still don't get the hate, and I love that people are kind of turning around on it. I've had my nitpicks and gripes from season to season, of course, but it's like, to me, the game's the game. And you know, I don't see it as any worse or whatever than, you know, any of these other things that people praise. So I don't know. I don't know what got in people's minds, but I think they were just ready to dogpile on it. You might have hit it that it might have been a, you know, Bethesda had this crazy run and people were just looking to knock them off the totem pole a little bit.
Yeah, that definitely can be the case.
Yeah. So, I want to talk a little bit about your upcoming game. I've seen the trailer and some gameplay, as I told you off mic. They very kindly offered me a code, but only for like Steam Deck. And I am the farthest thing from a PC player. I don't understand how to play PC. I just have I work off a Mac, so that doesn't help, you know. So all this stuff anyway. So I haven't gotten to actually play the game yet, but I'm a console guy, and I know it's hitting consoles at the end of the month. So I will absolutely be checking it out. But can you tell us a little bit about the Axis Unseen?
Sure, but first off, it's not actually consoles until maybe later, depending on how the game does. Since I'm a solo dev, I opted not to kill myself basically trying to ship that at the same time.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. But, you know, I was going off of the thing where it's like coming up on console. And then I'm like, okay, cool. So sure, it'll release then. So
might pop up on the Google thing. I need to fix that.
I'm not going to be of any help boosting those numbers. So I'm hoping that the listeners like make up for my my Luddite tree when it comes to gaming and PC gaming. So you guys go make it a hit so I can play it on my Xbox is what I need.
But yeah, I can go into what the game is.
Sure, please do.
So The Axis Unseen is a heavy metal horror game where you hunt monsters from folklore in a big open world. And it's closer to like a hunting simulator, not like a big action game. So like wind direction matters and the creatures can smell you. You eventually get magic powers to help. Because sometimes there's like a very large and very fast creatures. So there's a lot going on there.
Mm. What's it like going from... you know, one of the biggest video game companies in the world that you spent so many years of your life there, and you like go, okay, cool. Now I get to do my own thing on my own terms. You know, creatively, I can only imagine that it's, you know, it must be extremely fulfilling and probably very frustrating as you're, you know, trying to bring your vision to life. But it's got to be really great as a creative to go in and get to just build your own thing from the ground up.
Yeah, like it's basically why I left, really, is because the studio got so huge. Instead of being like, you know, 100 of us in the basement making Skyrim, it's like 500 people across 4 different companies, not including outsourcing. So I was in meetings all the time and all of this. So a lot of people quit studios like this and they go and like start their own studio. But I was like, I just want to make games and concentrate as much time as possible doing that. And I also had like 2 young kids. So my schedule is like super erratic. So I went the full solo route. Like I got some people to help with music and drawing and writing, but I'm the only actual like dedicated developer. And I've really, really enjoyed that because I just get to spend all my time solving problems and making cool stuff that no one is telling me what to do or when to finish it by. None of that. Like I could just change the release date right now if I wanted to. Like I'm not going to.
Yeah, I was going to... Gonna say, yeah, so get your pre-orders in now. Can you tell me a little bit about the tone, you know, because from the, you described it as a heavy metal horror game. Where's the heavy metal, like, come in? Is that a tonal thing? Is that just like how, you know, how visually it comes across? Because, you know, it looks beautiful from what I've seen.
It's kind of both. Like, aesthetically, I would say it's like, it's pretty metal. There's giant skeletons everywhere and blood and monsters, but also... it is the music to the game. Like I got Clifford Meyer from one of my favorite metal bands, Isis, which, you know, unfortunate name these days, but I've been a fan of them for ages. And I like reached out to them to license the song because I loved it and wanted to use it for my intro. But I mentioned I work on Skyrim and Clifford was like, oh, man, I love Skyrim. Are you looking for anyone to make music for your game? And I was like, yeah. So he ended up making the whole soundtrack. And so it has like this primitive metal soundtrack where it's like guitars and metal and everything, but then primitive drums and horns, because I wanted that like, you know, gritty, primitive feel to everything.
Well, you know, that's a great feeling for this kind of game. Like it, you can't go wrong with fire, skeletons. It seems like the combat is mostly bow and arrow from what I've seen. Is that true?
Yeah, you have your bow and arrow, but you can also like stab them in the face. And it's pretty effective, honestly. Like if a werewolf jumps in your face, you can just stab them. That said, that's like pretty high risk if you're going toe to toe with a giant monsters. I mean, some of them are like 30 stories tall. I don't know if you want to go stab them in the shins or whatever.
You're going to stab the pinky toe, try to get them to topple over. Yeah. And you're like, dude, you're giving away all the secrets there. Yeah. So what's probably the biggest challenge do you, for you as a solo developer? Is it just, you know, is it a timetable thing? Is it keeping like everything? Because I have to imagine if you're a solo developer, you're not only building the game, you're also doing all the business for the company at the same time. Like, so what's the biggest challenge once you kind of look back now that you have this thing about to come out? What was the thing that was the hardest thing for you to overcome?
Yeah, I mean, it is juggling a lot of different things, but I think I got pretty good at essentially having a set amount of time for a task and then doing it. Because at Bethesda, we couldn't just like noodle on stuff forever. We weren't doing like these linear games that are like hyper polished. We were just like, half my job was lighting. And normally that's like a whole team. So I got very fast at doing things, basically. So I think the biggest challenge really is just like when I'd run into like roadblocks every once in a while, because like I'm using Unreal Engine and I'm not doing it like with real code. It's this thing called Blueprint where you like lay out things visually. So I was always worried I would just like run into something like some weird crash where I'd be like, oh man, am I going to have to pay like $50,000 or $100,000 to some coder to go in there and like fix my garbage?
But untangle the rat's nest of
exactly. Sub-Yad. Like that could have absolutely happened, but that never actually occurred. Like the game has been super stable the whole time. I would like run it for days at shows and it would never crash. Like I did have roadblocks now and then, but I was able to like figure it out. And it helps when you're using something like Unreal where you like run into a problem. So then you just go to Google and you're like, blah, blah, blah is broken. Unreal. And somebody probably ran into that problem.
It's pretty incredible. Google's doing everything they can with this AI search shit and all the sponsored links taking up the first like two pages of results and stuff. Now they're doing what they can to fuck this up, but it's pretty incredible how you can pretty much decide today I'm going to do just about anything. You want to learn how to take an engine apart, you want to build a lawnmower, like you could literally just type that into Google and there will be video walkthroughs that will tell you step by step how to do anything. Like if I need anything replaced on my car, I look it up first and see like, do I need a special tool to do it? Nope, you just need 15 minutes and a screwdriver and you can replace the broken side mirror of your car or something. It's like, oh, I'm not spending $500 on that anymore. It is crazy the time that we live in now where you could just do that. That's how the KingCast got to be a thing. Like anytime I'd run into a problem, I just Google like, how do you get in a podcast on the Apple Podcast, how do you get it on the Spotify? Like literally, that was pretty much anytime I ran into a problem. And when I've been tasked with doing like any solving for anything, like I legitimately just go, I'm going to do the same thing you could do, from whether it's, my fiance asking me for something or a friend asking me for something. I'd be like, I don't know the answer to that, but I'm going to do what you could do. I'm just going to go to Google so you can find it.
Yeah. So many more things are possible. Like there's no way I could have built this game even like 10 years ago.
So the game is out on the 22nd, and that's going to be out on Steam?
Yeah, it's going to be on Steam and the Unreal Store, or Epic Store.
Right. Nice. Well, again, I hope that everybody makes it a giant success so I can actually play it when with my controller on my Xbox. And I wish you well with that. Let's transition a little bit into some Stephen King stuff. What's your Stephen King origin story?
I'm pretty sure that the first Stephen King thing that I ever saw was like Carrie when I was way too young. And it definitely that movie is quite memorable, especially the ending.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There's something about that, that prom scene that hits on a primal level. There's some way that Sissy Spacek plays it, with the blankness in her eyes, the way that De Palma's using the split screen, just the level of chaos and anarchy and, I don't know, people who don't deserve death getting killed and alongside the bullies that you're hoping get killed. And yeah, there's something very, and it's also just extremely well shot. It's, I think one of the best single frames of any Stephen King adaptation is just the silhouette of Carrie against the fire, the bloody Carrie, with the background of the fire.
Yeah, I feel like that's absolutely iconic.
It's something that it's hard to plan for, but it's there and it's incredible. So movies were the thing that kind of got you aware of this dude?
Yeah, like I read books later. But that was the first time that I came across his stuff that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. I mean, I grew up in the, my childhood was through the 80s and early 90s. So I, that was kind of the heyday where you can be guaranteed that, there's going to be a Stephen King book on your parents' bookshelf at some point. And so that was around, but it, you know, I was a movie kid, so I'm the exact same way. I came to King through the movies, and I used the movies as a way to get into reading, because I was like, I've seen the movie Cujo, so I can read the book now, because I know what happens. I know who the characters are, so I can picture Dee Wallace in my head when I read about Donna Trenton, and I can picture the kid, I can picture the dog, you know. I figured that was going to be my training wheels to read a quote unquote, you know, grown up book. Was that your experience too, or did you read a little bit later in your adulthood?
I read a lot as a kid and stuff. It's just when I would go to the library, it would be like hard to convince my parents that was okay to get like horror books and stuff. Because I mean, I grew up in the '80s and stuff too. And so that was back in the day of like, you know, Satanic Panic and everyone thinking nerds playing D&D was like summoning the devil and stuff. So it was a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. I mean, people, the kids today who only know that stuff through Stranger Things, that shit was very real. I mean, I don't know if they had roving mobs of, Chads running around, you know, beating up D&D kids, but you know, the Satanic Panic stuff was all over the news every fucking night. But that said, it was also an era where, you know, pre-helicopter parenting. So like, I think that if you had the gumption, if you were sneaky enough as a kid, in the '80s and into the early '90s, maybe you could get away with a lot and sneak a lot of things, but, a lot more than you can today anyway.
Yeah, you wait until the parents are asleep, put on, if you have cable TV, find the channels playing the monster movies.
The monster movies or the booby movies, you know, one of the two. Yeah. Yeah. It's, it was an interesting era, this pre-internet, you know, era where, you know, before the internet drove all of our parents fucking crazy in some way, shape or form. But yeah, it was kind of the heyday of Stephen King stuff and being able to see and discover things too young. I think that this generation is seeing and discovering more crazy things younger, thanks to the internet and the easy access to just about anything you could desire to search for. But, you know, they're also way protected in a way that we weren't, you know. So I don't know. I wish that the adventurousness of youth was a little bit more like, you know, and I sound like an old man shaking his fist at the clouds here, but a little bit more like it was back in the '80s, because you could, there was something tangible about it, and discover, you know, combing through VHSs at a yard sale and picking out, you know, one that maybe was inappropriate, or picking up a Stephen King book and sneaking it, you know, if you didn't think your parents were going to allow you to do it or whatnot. I don't know. There seems to be something maybe a little bit more romantic about the hands-on sneakiness versus just sitting there on your iPad or your phone and getting around a parent lock, you know?
I mean, I think that's why stuff like Stranger Things does so well, is because there's like a nostalgia for that time and the kids going on adventures like that. I mean, the It movie has a lot of that same kind of vibe too. Book, obviously.
Yeah, see, if they remake It again for the, you know, if they update it like they did, where they went from the original, you know, 50s, 60s era to the 80s now, I don't know how you're going to do the aughts version, you know, of it, the nostalgic aughts and early 20-teens version of the story.
Like the parents get arrested because the kids are out on their own.
Yeah, the kids are out past dark, and everybody calls the police because, you know, surely this kid's lost and needs help, you know. And they also wouldn't know how to ride a bike, so, you know, there's all that stuff. They'd be going around on Segways or something, I don't know. So the title, even though it was floated, Misery was floated, and again, I apologize, unfortunately, we just covered it, so that would have been a little bit too much for the listeners, but the title you settled on was The Mist. So can you tell me why this title is the one that jumped out to you?
I mean, I watched like a lot of horror movies over the years, and you know, I'm making a horror game now, but like The Mist is one of those movies that just like absolutely sticks with you. Like, I'd be shocked if anybody like forgot that ending. It's absolutely one of the most impactful endings, and I just love the whole thing, really, for a whole bunch of different reasons, but that part in particular is just timeless.
Did you see the movie when it came out, when it first came out, like in theaters?
I honestly don't remember if I saw it in theaters or not, because at first I was like, I know it's been a while, but then I looked up when it was and it's like, oh, 2007. That's longer than I thought.
Yeah. I vividly remember feeling the audience like jerk away from that finale. You know, like there was a revulsion in the audience of not, this isn't the way things are supposed to go. And I've been delighted by it since day one, since pre day one. So I got to spend a little time on that set. I also like, you know, it's a long story, but there was, you know, Frank Darabont was a big reader of a site that I wrote for called Ain't It Cool News. And I met him at some film festival where he was like doing a talk on something. And we kept in touch after that. And like, he knew I was a big Stephen King nerd. So he sent me like his draft of the Mist before he got funding. And, with that ending in there, and apparently when they shot, they didn't, that ending was not given out, only to the people who were in the scene, I guess. So most people didn't know what the ending was, but I'm like walking around in there and like, oh, I know the ending. And everybody's like, you know, the ending, what is it? What is it? I'm like, I can't tell you. I'm going to get in trouble now. Like you don't, there are a lot of people in this world that you, you know, shouldn't mind getting angry at you. And Frank Darabont is not one of those people. So I didn't want Frank Darabont on my case. You know, I think that I had two immediate reactions to The Mist when I saw it. One is, I had, obviously, since I was on set, I had a heads up of what the style of the movie was, where it's a little bit more chaotic than the classical, controlled, measured Darabont that we'd seen up to this point. The Green Mile, the Shawshank Redemption, Majestic, you know, that stuff. But that was still very jarring to me because I had pictured in my mind him taking that elegant style and applying it to this very pulpy B-movie story that King wrote. And I was so fascinated by that concept, and that wasn't what the movie was. So I remember having a reaction to that going, you know, is where I had to meet the movie on its own terms, where I was like, this is what, you know, the energy that this is giving, you know, there's a reason why he's doing this. And, and it took me a second to get over that. It took me a second to get over some of the wonky CG, but I've always been captivated by the storytelling that goes on in the movie. And, I love the lead performance from Tom Jane. I love all the actors in the movie. They give it 110%. But it was just aesthetically, I had to, you know, kind of readjust what I thought I wanted from the movie. And now it's, you know, it's hard to imagine the movie without that energy, without the whipping cameras and the not cutting around the zoom outs and zoom ins and stuff. You know, there's something to that, you know, very specific cop drama TV of that era style that he was lifting. That is just part of the identity of the movie for me now.
Yeah, I think that stuff works really well because to me that captures like the stress of that situation and the feeling of just like not being able to manage all these people and emotions and all of the things that go down there. Because it is chaotic.
Yeah, and it's chaotic and claustrophobic. I mean, to catch the listener up, if there's somebody who is listening to probably the third episode or fourth episode we've ever done on The Mist over 4 years, and they love Stephen King but somehow don't know this title, this is all about a mysterious mist that rolls into a small town, and we focus on a group of people trapped in a small town grocery store as this mist hiding creatures of all shapes, sizes, and deadliness in it outside. And what do they, you know, what do they do? How do they react? And it's mostly about the microcosms that develop within that store, and it quickly turns into Stephen King's Lord of the Flies. So you got the religious extremists starting a cult in, you know, in there after 2 days. You got the good people trying to, you know, help society, their little society, and usually punished for it. You know, it's a wonderful little, you know, deepness that King adds to what's on its surface is just a cheesy B movie about monsters hiding in fog, right? So, I think that that's another thing that gets people. It's one of the things that grabbed me as a fan of the original novella. But the reason why the movie sticks with people and why the ending is so impactful to people is that they actually give a shit about all these people in the situation, because there's a darker, deeper theme going on inside, away from the monsters.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, that's one of my favorite genres of horror, really, is like this kind of trapped situation, whatever.
Right.
If there's a genre name for that, you know, like 10 Cloverfield Lane or like From, the TV show.
Of the Living Dead, even, you know, Dawn of the Dead. Yeah,
exactly. Because you can just get so much interest out of the different characters and the way they interact in these high stress scenarios where they don't have a way out to just like ask for help.
And so the ending, have you ever read the original novella, or do you?
I have not.
So it's interesting. Do you know much about the differences between the novella and the movie?
No, hit me.
For the most part, it's very similar. But the ending is where Darabont diverged. And the ending of the original is they drive away and they don't run out of gas. They, you know, the last thing that we see is they pull up, the mist just goes on and on and on, and they pull up into a Howard Johnson's, I believe, a Hojo. And, you know, then they go inside and like they take shelter there for a bit. The lead like is writing a letter or something and leaving a letter for if anybody comes across it. And essentially you get that same feeling of like, oh, there's a behemoth out there. There's something that they drive through its footsteps, and it's a Godzilla style monster. And like, if that exists, then like humanity's probably doomed. But it ends on a little note of hope where the, like they're scrolling, like they heard a word through the static on the radio, and it's a location, and they're going to drive towards that location, and maybe there's still some people left, and maybe there's a way to, you know, combat the mist or reverse it. And which in a weird way is interesting, because the mist gets knocked for its dark ending. And I've always said that the mist ending in the movie is way better. It's a way more positive, upbeat ending, just not for David Drayton. Like, for all right, of humanity,
everybody else,
you know, the lady that walks out and walks back to her kids, like, you know, everybody else, the ending of The Mist is a happy story. The army fights it back. They figured out a way to combat it. You know, humanity's gonna win. You do not get that in the novella. The novella is like, oh God, like, please let there be a chance that humanity might have an answer to this. But you know, it also doesn't end with a giant murder spree in a Jeep. So,
that's why I think that works so well, because it's like that contrast. Because usually it's kind of one way or the other, like, oh, the final girl escapes, or humanity is doomed, but mm-hmm. This is like this cool blend of the two, and that's why it works so well. Because that's why it's like even more painful for him, is because you know that he's probably gonna have to go back to like a mostly regular life, and then just think about it forever, like every day, and that's horrifying.
If there is a day beyond that day, you know what I mean? It's like, once you're that broken and you've taken that step, like, I don't see that guy recovering. That guy's going to end up in a home somewhere, right? Like, there's,
oh yeah, he is broken.
So broken. And I love how pitch black that is for that character, because it is, you know, I think I've made an argument that I think that movies that end on downers like that are very important, and more important than they're given credit for, because nobody wants to make that, because nobody wants to finance and not nobody wants to make it. Creatives love to fuck with audience expectations, but talking about the money people, right? The money people don't want to finance that shit because they want a return on their investment, and nothing gives you an F cinema score quicker than a downer ending, right? But those are the things that help make every other movie dangerous. So there is a chance when you're watching, you know, the fourth in the sequel to your favorite, you know, franchise movie, there's a chance somebody's going to fucking die, and it's in the back of your mind going, you know, surely they won't kill Indiana Jones off or whatever, right? But they could. Frank Darabont did it in The Mist. You know, it's like every once in a while you'll get one of those fucking real bleak bleak endings. So I think that like having that as a possibility in the cinema goers' minds is extremely valuable, and it helps so many other movies beyond just the movie that has that ending.
Yeah, I think it's super important to have stuff like that. And to me, it has like a big impact. I'm definitely not one of those people that like always wants a happy ending. And I feel like things have gotten a little better with that overall, because I feel like growing up, TV shows and stuff, you would be like, the main characters, they're pretty much always going to be fine. But yeah. Now you get stuff like Game of Thrones or like The 100, where like pretty notable characters were like, oh, they just like straight up murder that dude.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to actually have that for a change, because like you said, then you get like actual stakes. Because if it's just, oh, they're going to be fine because it's a movie and it's going to end well, or it's a TV show and that's a main character, like, that's boring.
It does, and it gets that way. And I think that that's, you know, to cite another Frank Darabont example, it's something he grabbed onto with The Walking Dead, right? And if you remember in the first, Darabont only lasted two seasons on that, but what was crazy about that show is all nobody was safe. And the second that they whittled it down to, all right, well, Norman Reedus ain't never going anywhere, you know, Carol's never going anywhere, then that's when the show had to transition and become something else. And it's more this, it transformed from this kind of grounded, like realistic zombie scenario to, you know, everybody's crazy and that dude has a fucking tiger. And, you know, it's like, you know, they kept having to up the stakes, and they have to compensate for the fact that the draw for the early seasons of that show was, you know, I love or love watching at the very least all these people in this group, and any one of them can go at any point, including in, you know, not limited to the lead of the series. So
yeah, and I think that's why a lot of people fell off of it. Like, it's fine when I've gone back to it, but I ultimately, every time I've gone back, I've just stopped at some point.
Yeah,
whereas the start of it was so strong.
Yeah, it just got a little bit too much. So if you were in a Mist situation and you were trapped in that supermarket, what's your, like, what do you make of all this stuff? Or do you think that you would ever succumb to the Mist Carmody's of the world? Or would you always be the outcast, you know, kind of on the fringes trying to keep your sanity? Like, what do you think?
Oh, I think I'm like a hardcore rationalist and would definitely be on the side of the people trying to actually be sane and make it out of that. Like, one of my favorite books growing up was this book called Demon Haunted World by Carl Sagan.
Mm.
And it's very relevant to this movie because it's a lot about how people sort of embrace ignorance in a way and can like almost make it their identity and use it as an excuse to do all these horrible things and not be rational. So that's something that has been on my mind ever since I was like a young kid growing up around a whole bunch of people in the woods who are very similar to that in a lot of ways.
Mm. So do you think your rationality would fuck you in the early moments of this where you couldn't buy that it's tentacle monsters outside?
I mean, I think that's why it's important that they did have Andre Brower's character in there, because it is that other side, right, of like embracing rationality to the point of not actually being rational and like ignoring evidence. So that was really interesting how they had that contrast of those two extremes and how it's saying like, you can't actually go that far because that's toxic as well.
And the way that he argues, like, I remember at the time going, oh, he's just being a stubborn asshole and whatnot. But now the way that he argues with David Drayton's like, I have evidence. Let me show you evidence in the last 10 years in particular. And the way the divide has happened and the way misinformation is out there and so prevalent and how nobody believes anything, you know, and nobody has the baseline of reality and facts that are facts. You know, how just frustrating that conversation is, you know, that strikes me every time I get to that part where he's like, they're like, I'm going to show you, like, I have a piece of this thing back there. And he's like, oh, I have an explanation for it. Oh, that's just, you're going to show me a rubber thing and you're going to expect me to quiver in my boots. And it's really sad that, you know, that's just become kind of the norm in terms of having any conversation with anybody about anything these days.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, a lot more impactful these days, and like is frankly just obviously going to get way, way worse with like people AI generating voices and faces and everything. And like so many people are going to get scammed out of that because of that stuff. Like,
yeah,
you won't be able to believe anything that you see unless it's like actually in front of your face.
Yeah. And then, you know, even then we're going to be all wearing some sort of crazy Zuckerberg, you know, augmented reality headwear or something, you know, I don't know. But it doesn't bode well. Like I would love just to get back to a baseline of like we're all arguing from the same, you know, the same accepted, you know, the earth is round. I mean, come on, we have, you know, we have literal satellites that are doing like, in it's like I don't know what it is that broke people, but something happened, because this has happened even pre-COVID. I think COVID accelerated it, but in the lockdown of people just getting inside their own minds and conspiracy thinking, you know, once you're isolated and all that stuff gets worse. But I don't know what the fuck is in the water and why this is happening to such a degree, but there's some sort of mixture of stubbornness and just so sure that you're in on a dirty secret that they don't want you to know. I don't know. The reality, I guess what I'm getting to is that looking around today, my views on how funny and authorly, you know, it is to build a click system in this kind of horror movie scenario or horror story scenario, how quaint it is and how funny it is in a good way into it. Now I look at it going, that's probably on the calm version of what would actually happen if a mist rolled through. You know, everybody would hoard in that thing, they would hoard the toilet paper for some reason, and they would be offering sacrifices within 48 hours. You know, it's like,
oh yeah, it's totally you know. Believable.
Yeah, I think I think the mist doesn't go far enough to show just how batshit crazy people will get in a stress situation like this.
Yeah, things have definitely accelerated on the misinformation front. Like I miss the good old days when it was like just people wearing tinfoil hats, like the crazy uncle who had conspiracy theories. Now it's like, oh wait, no, people actually believe that.
And I think everybody has a pet conspiracy theory now too. I'm sure I do. And as I was bringing it up, I'm like, well, what is mine? I think everybody's got one that maybe makes a little bit of sense to them, whether it's there was definitely a second gunman on the grassy knoll or whatever, you know, but I don't know. Like, I think that us as humans, we just like to feel like we have information that other people don't. And I think that like a lot of religious zealotry comes from that. And there's like, you know, like, well, I know the real truth and you don't, and I'm going to pray for you on it, you know, but you're not really, you know. I don't know. There's something about human nature that, you know, that kind of gravitates towards that kind of thinking. I think we'd be much better as a society if we didn't, but you know, that's kind of not how we're built. So
yeah, I think people like to have a villain in a lot of cases, someone to blame for all the problems.
Yeah. I mean, I'm guilty of that as well, but it's, you know, sometimes there are villains out there and sometimes, you know, people paint themselves as the heroic saviors, and then you get you got to make sure you're not Miss Carmody as you're, you know, really patting yourself on the back for the, you know, the moral righteousness that you're embodying. Right. So do you have a favorite creature that is showcased in this film? Is there something that stands out to you as being particularly effective?
I really, really like that the giant one at the end. Because it encapsulates a lot about what I like about the monsters in that movie, where it's like so big and uncaring, and then also has like all the smaller creatures are flying around it. Because the whole thing with the mist is that so many movies are just like, it's a monster movie, right? There's the monster. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the mist, it's like a horror ecosystem has moved in. It's like a whole nother world. And like, they're just going about the way they would do things. Like, they're not out to get the people, really. They're just like, they're going to eat sometimes. And I think that's really interesting and reminds me a lot of, you know, like Half-Life, the game back in the day, is the same kind of idea of like a whole nother dimension of creatures just crosses over into our own.
It jumps on your head like a little hat. Yeah. 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 there's something about humbling humanity at the center of this, which is really interesting, where we're so used to being the top of the food chain. And then, like you said, it's not, the tentacles aren't there with a purpose trying to fuck with humans and knowing that they're toying with their prey or whatever. They're no different than just like an anteater sticking its tongue into an ant colony. You know, it's suddenly you're very low on the totem pole, and you know, and it's frightening. I get it. There's, you know, the fact that this behemoth could walk by and not even notice you, and there's just something so wonderfully cosmic horror about that, and how insignificant you are in this new normal, and how weak and, you know, I don't know, the invulnerable. That's just such a wonderful feeling to kind of hammer home that dread. And I think you need that scene in order to sell the ending. You don't get there without that scene. And for a lot of people, that ending still, they can't hang with. But in particular, imagine how people would have revolted if they just driven around without seeing that and then ran out of gas and was like, all right, now it's time to kill everybody in the car. Say goodbye, son, you know?
Yeah, it would feel so much more pointless. Whereas when they see that, it just feels like this. It really drives home how completely insurmountable of an obstacle this is. Like, no chance.
Mm. Do you think that you could have ever done what David Drayton does in this situation? Because I don't think I could have. I'd much, even though he makes the promise to his kid that he won't let the monsters get him, you know, and that ultimately I don't know, like a mercifully quick exit to this crazy world. I don't think I could do it. It's the same way where I'm not the guy that in the horror movie, whenever they fucking hit a deer or a rabbit or something, and it's in the middle of the road and they're like, put it out of its misery. I can't bring myself to do that. Like, I'm not that guy. I couldn't do that. So I think that I would have bumblefucked my way into a happy ending, maybe. Because I could never have done what he did. Go ahead.
I was gonna say I definitely not. And I first watched this before I had kids, but then I rewatched it this past week. Now I have like two young kids, and I'm like, no way, man. I would have been like, let's go hide in the gutters along the side of the highway and crawl and just try whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great things, and one of the reasons why I think the movie really people have visceral reactions to this thing, and I think a lot of it's because David Drayton makes all the choices that we would make when, you know, you always have that thing. It's like, what would I do in this situation? Like, if I was John McClane, you know, yeah, I could totally do that badass thing, even though nobody would actually jump off of a fucking building. You know, it's like, but you like to do that projection. And I think, you know, one of my theories is that one of the reasons people have such a visceral reaction to the ending is, up until that point, David Drayton has made all the right choices, all the morally correct choices. You know, that dude's in pain. I'm going to lead the next expedition to the pharmacy to get him some painkillers. And then that gets fucked up. People die, and only, you know, and the guy is dead by the time they come back anyway. Like, he makes all these right choices and is never rewarded for them. And matter of fact, is punished. And yet some of the reckless people, the lady that walks home to her children, for example, you know, does a reckless thing, and he doesn't support it, and he's scared to do that, and he pays a price for it. And I think that people are so used to movies always rewarding good behavior that they have kind of a really negative reaction whenever good behavior isn't rewarded. Thomas Jane's character in here, David Drayton, he is whatever the opposite of a reward is, he gets in this scenario. Do you think I'm onto something there, or am I just like reaching for something crazy?
I think so, because it feels like so deeply unfair, especially with, you know, the army rolling through right after. You're just like, man, he just got like so screwed by just a matter of seconds. But that's part of why I think the script works so well for me, is because there's so many horror things or sci-fi things like Prometheus, where the plot is always driven forward by, frankly, people doing dumb things.
Mm-hmm.
But like, he does risky things, but they're not dumb. Like, there's logic behind it.
Yeah.
But then that happens, and yeah, it feels unfair, but it's hard to say, like, if all these people were put in that situation, who would actually do that and not, because it is hopeless. Like, it's understandable, even if it is absolutely horrible. Like, you can understand what he's thinking.
Yeah.
Like, most of that is done without dialogue. They just, like, look at each other and, like, nod. They all understand that they're, like, screwed.
And I think Tom Jane, like, gives the best bit of acting he's ever done in his entire career is in that moment where you, like, when he's dry firing into his mouth, and, you know, he's just, it feels like waves are hitting him, like waves of reality, and then he, like, deflates and just completely disassociates, and then he comes back and screams, and then he disassociates. There's just something about that reads so fucking real to me, that to me that's his Sean Penn Mystic River, you know, moment where, like, fucking, I think Penn won an Oscar for that, and I'm like, Tom Jane should have been nominated for you know, that kind of reality. Like, I flash on, like, Tom Hanks at the end of Captain Phillips too, where there's just that very realistic, you know, post-traumatic stress reaction that he's having.
Yeah, it's just such a strong visceral reaction, but, you know, horror always gets snubbed for awards, so
always, unless you're Kathy Bates, and there's your Misery connection.
That's true.
The only Oscar that any Stephen King thing has ever won for any category is Kathy Bates in Misery. Nominated many times, and that's the only winner. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you agree with my feelings on that. And then what you get, like, all those movies that do super well, that people just act like it's not horror. Like, sorry, dude, but Jaws is a horror movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jaws is definitely a monster movie. Silence of the Lambs is not a psychological thriller. It's a fucking horror movie. The dude butterfly fillets a fucking cop and hangs him up for decoration. It's like, there's, you know, he wears another dude's face to escape. It's a fucking horror movie. He's a cannibal. He eats people. I'm sorry. Yeah, I definitely die. And I've been in long arguments with friends about this as well. You know, I've had that argument of Silence of the Lambs is more of a thriller. I'm like, well, kind of, it's not Terrifier, but it's, you know, it's not a Friday the 13th movie, but there can be different shades of horror.
Yeah, it's just that thing where it's always been treated like sort of a lowbrow form of entertainment, where if you ask me, horror is often at sort of the forefront of pushing the medium and doing, like, really interesting things, and it has often been, like, way better for diversity and people who maybe weren't able to make films at the time. So I do not agree with that position. And I think horror is awesome.
Well, yeah, I agree too. But I also think part of its awesome status is its outsider status. And I think that's why it was a home for, you know, before LGBTQ was a thing, you know, when it was the just a straight up gay or lesbian community, there was a reason why exploitation and horror was where they gravitated towards, you know, and that where they were given voice and given, you know, a platform. And there's some, it could all, I mean, listen, there's a ton of very homophobic, you know, early 80s movies, horror movies, but there's also, you know, there's a lot of, queer identity that is shown in horror, and horror that became a place for it, you know, before the indie film scene, you know, the 90s, you know, before we could get Hedwig and the Angry Inch, we had to get Rocky Horror. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, there, you know, there's something about that. And I don't know if it was, and I was about to say, I don't know if it's more, you know, if it was more mainstream, if it would still have that outsider thing, kind of like how, you know, comic book movies, when they became the mainstream, you know, now a lot of people who felt like that was their thing, now it's like, well, now cheerleaders and jocks like it, so I can't like it, which is a bullshit thing.
That happens, you know, every time.
It always happens. I was gonna say that, but, you know, ultimately horror is never, it's an outsider thing, but it's also a populist thing. It's a contradiction, because it pushes the envelope in ways that most blockbuster filmmaking can't, but it's also, it's also dependable. Everybody, like, you know, cheap horror movies are like the bread and butter and the backbone of the film industry and keeping in the distribution industry, you know, keeping theaters open. You know, it's not for the, you know, the Joker, you know, the two debuting to, you know, a third of what the first one did. That's, you know, that's a big hit. It's like all these crazy, the fact that, you know, I saw the Substance last night after it's been out for 2.5 weeks and it was a full theater. You know, people like hear that stuff and they always gravitate towards horror. So it is at once an outsider art, but everybody, even if they hate horror movies, you know, maybe because they're conditioned because it's October, you go to horror movies or your friends drag you or whatever. Horror movies have always been the secret weapon of the industry, is just these, you know, they don't require stars. They don't require giant budgets to get asses in seats. And, you know, they're kind of a unique genre in that aspect, where the star is the trailer, really. The star is the, if you can, you know, you can have Smile come out and be the biggest movie of the year because, you know, they have a really effective horror trailer, even though nobody knows anybody in the film, you know?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it's always been fascinating watching like that dichotomy between those two things, where it's like people almost don't want to acknowledge the fact that they want to see it. And it's such a mainstay. And it's the same with games, too, where horror is one of the most popular genres. And that's part of why I decided to do a horror game, really. Mm. Like, I mean, obviously, I'm into horror a lot, but I did also do like my market research or whatever. And it is a very strong genre, and it like resonates really well with streamers. Like, they have lots of big moments watching the games. Yeah. That is 100% a thing.
How, I mean, I have to imagine, especially going the indie game route, it's gotta be crucial to get, to kind of build your game around what you know is going to, get views and get people watching on Twitch and watching their favorite Twitch streamer or whatever doing the game. I have to imagine that's such a huge part of all that now. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And that's why I have a lot of things in my game that are sort of consciously designed around having those big reactions and stuff. And horror is the perfect fit for that, really. So I think it makes a lot of sense versus if you're doing, say, like a side scrolling pixel art indie platformer. Like, it's incredibly hard to stand out and have exciting moments in a lot of ways, and right, that's why a lot of those just don't sell. Like, there's thousands of games that come out every year, and you need to find a way to really, really stand out.
When you're building a horror game from the ground up, like, where, you know, I'm curious where what the emphasis is. Like, what's the priority for you as, you know, developing this thing?
I guess my priority and the way I like to build games in general is I like to build a world, really. That's why I've really liked building open world games like this.
Yeah.
So somewhere you can like really immerse yourself in. And that's why I put like as much of the UI, you know, the user interface stuff as possible in the world, on like your bow and your hands. Cause I just wanted to really, really draw people into the world. That way they're not just like staring at a mini map in the corner, right? I feel like it's going to be harder to have an impact on someone when Bigfoot comes out of the forest and punches him in the face if they're sitting there staring at some little menu.
Yeah, as they're watching the dot get closer and closer, like aliens. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, actually, speaking of aliens, that's one of the powers that I put in. Like, you collect all these sense powers, and like, I always love that scene in Aliens, but, you know, again, I don't want the UI. So instead I have like this little tattoo that flares up on your hand, and you just know that like something is moving by. And if it's like cold color, it's small, but then if it's warm, it's big. So you kind of know something's nearby and how big it is, but you don't know where. And I use this audio trick that I think is super cool. It's called a shepherd tone, where it always sounds like it's raising in pitch just forever. And it's used in a whole bunch of movies and stuff as a way to help build tension. So you just hear that rising tone. And I put that as like the first power you find. I'm like, oh, this feels great. Cause then everyone is like on edge.
Right. Can I ask you a developer question? Because one thing that I've always been nostalgic for, and something that I think would be absolutely killer that people don't do much anymore, and I don't know if there's a regulation reason for this. But do you know the game Eternal Darkness?
Yeah, I know that game. That's an awesome game.
The thing that I will always, I'm flabbergasted even bringing this up, because it's kind of this Lovecraftian thing where you can like cast spells and whatnot as you're going through this Lovecraftian like mansion-y thing. But what's fucked up about that game is you have a sanity meter, and the lower your sanity, the more likely you you get player aimed sanity things, where it's not just your character, where it'll look like you're, you know, at the time you're a connected cord, you know, controller or whatever was unplugged, or the volume in your TV goes all the way down and is muted. Yeah. Like you sat on your remote or something. I'm so surprised that games don't use that kind of shit more. And I wonder if there's like a relegatory reason for it, where you can't fuck with people in the same way that the Eternal Darkness people did. Is this something you have any thoughts on or know anything about?
Yeah, I mean, they very well could be, because they, especially on consoles, like on PC, you can basically release whatever, and I'm not aware of any rules there. But if you're releasing on a console, there is all these like weird rules about like, this is what happens if you unplug this controller and then plug that one in at the same time, or the batteries go out, or
yeah,
bring up the menu. They do have a whole process called certification, and it is dealing with exactly that kind of stuff. And that's part of why I'm not doing day one console launch, honestly, is it's like this manual of rules that you have to follow. Mm-hmm. And it's mind numbing.
Well, I mean, listen, I'm sure they're there for a reason, enough, you know, and I get under needing to have some sort of rules in place. I've done that. I've had, you know, disconnect problems because of my batteries ran out on my Xbox controller, and I plugged it back in and then it has trouble connecting again, or the game freaks out and crashes to dash or something. I understand why they're trying to limit that. But man, every time I think about Eternal Darkness, I go, there is so many ways that you could fuck with the people playing games. And maybe we missed a great era with the Kinect era, you know, where you could... Like, can you imagine like playing, if the Kinect had like been something that people still used or whatever, and you're playing and it flashes and you see yourself playing and there's somebody fucking standing behind you or something, you know, I mean, there could be so many fucking cool things that are done. And maybe this does all exist in you know, maybe there is a version of this that happens in PC, the PC world, which, as much of a, you know, I give a lot of my life to video games still to this day, you know, I know almost nothing about that side of the gaming.
I mean, those rules can be broken. Like they make exceptions sometimes, especially if they know something is going to sell well. It's probably just harder on like the indie side.
Right.
So, you know, there's a chance.
Okay. So GTA 6 going to fuck with you is what you're saying. Yeah.
Could be. Probably a Kojima game, honestly.
Oh, yeah. No, the PlayStation will get it first for sure. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about this stuff with me, Nate. This has been a really fun chat. Do you want to give one more pitch for everybody for the brand new game and tell them where they can find it?
Yeah, so if the idea of playing a heavy metal horror game where you hunt monsters from folklore sounds cool to you, you can go to Steam and go and grab the demo, and it's called The Axis Unseen. And also with the demo, by the way, any progress that you make in it will automatically carry forward into the main game, because that has honestly been like a pet peeve of mine. I'm like, I don't want to replay the same thing, right?
And yeah, I hate it so much.
Right, like I just straight up won't play a demo because of that. So yeah, it'll just transfer it forward automatically for you, and then all the achievements unlock right away when you load your save.
Well, wonderful. That's a big a big selling point, I think, to a lot of people, to like, hey, we're gonna test it out, and the time you're gonna just carry it forward. So yeah, thanks, man. I really appreciate the chat, and I wish you all the luck in the world with the release.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Many thanks to Nate Perkypile for joining me for that chat on random video game shit, Frank Darabont's The Mist, and Stephen King. I probably could have grilled him a little bit more about the disastrous launch of Fallout 76, but I stand by everything I said there. I still play 76 off and on. Let's not get crazy here. But it's still a world I love to get lost in, and I think it still gets too much shit. So count me under the Fallout 76. Pretty good. Don't quit being little whiny babies about it. So, I want to give you guys a heads up on what's coming up next week. It's going to be a good one. It had to be. I mean, this is our Halloween era episode. It's not quite on Halloween. I think it's the day before. I think we're on October 30th is the Wednesday that the next KingCast will launch. So not quite Halloween day, but I knew I wanted to do it upright, and do it upright I did. We have for you next week one of the best living genre authors in the world, and he is a big Stephen King fan, and he wanted to talk about Revival. So we kind of use Revival as a jumping off point to launch into the career, the work, and the influence of one Mr. Joe R. Lansdale. That's the creator of the Happen Leonard books. He's the author of Bubba Hotep that was turned into that movie by Don Coscarelli. And he is here. He's a Texas writer. And if you've never read any of his stuff, I highly recommend seeking out some of his short stories. The way Stephen King writes about Maine, Joe Lansdale writes about East Texas and capturing an authentic voice of the region. And, you know, knowing Joe, throwing in some weird shit along the way to really shake things up. So Joe Lansdale's the guest, and I'm joined by our mutual friend, Stephen Graham Jones. You know him, you love him. And yes, of course, he can't come on the show and not fucking bring up some random wild animal encounter. So you're going to get yet another one, not a sad one this time. There was one episode where we actually had to put a content warning because Stephen decided he wanted to talk about some really awful things regarding baby cats that he had to deal with as a young farm boy in nowhere, Texas. So it's a really fun episode. Those two are great together. I had a blast with it. I think you guys are going to like it too. And as always, I want to make sure everybody signed up for our Patreon. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. We'll have a bonus episode for you this Friday, as we always do. And yeah, if you sign up now, throw us a few bucks and you'll get instant access to our Discord. You'll get instant access to over 4 years worth of bonus episodes. That's tons of work from me and Scott, because we do one episode a week on the Patreon that's available only there. So if you're listening to the main feed and the main feed only, you're only getting half the show. Throw us a few bucks. We make it worth your while. And it is the best way that you can contribute to keeping the show going. So once again, patreon.com/thekingcast. And the last thing I want to bring up before bringing the sucker in for a landing is at the time you're hearing this, I will be a day away from appearing at KingCon in Las Vegas, where I'm going to be doing a live recording of the KingCast there with Mr. Thomas Jane. So if you are in or around Las Vegas Thursday evening, the 24th of October, I think there's still a few tickets left to KingCon. All you need is a KingCon badge and you can wander your way into that panel and listen to me bullshit about some random stuff with Tom Jane. And it's going to be a wild experience. So I'm excited for that. I love Vegas. I love talking with Thomas Jane. And I think it's going to be one for the record books. If you can't make it, I'm pretty sure, unless there's an audio fuck up somewhere along the line, I'm pretty sure I'll be throwing that into the main feed at some point once I get the recording back. But you never know what goes on. This might be the only chance that you'll get to hear this episode if you're there live in the audience. So I highly recommend stopping by the Link Hotel, picking up a badge for King Con, hanging out with a bunch of Stephen King obsessed nerds, and you know, listening to this conversation with Mr. Tom Jane. So yeah, I think that's about it for all the housekeeping. I guess I'll see y'all next week in the main feed for that chat with Mr. Joe R. Lansdale with special guest co-host Stephen Graham Jones. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abby Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.